I first met our speaker many, many years ago, and after having the honor of being able to do the secretary for this, she was the first person that I thought of, because she's just the embodiment of what it's to be an Alcoholics Anonymous, to be an active, sober, long-time member. So without any further ado, Trish, come on up and tell us your story, please.
I'd like to thank Derek for asking me to speak tonight. It's really my pleasure to be able to speak or talk anywhere, anytime. And I'm Trish, and I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date's March 15th, 1979. I didn't know that I was going to stay sober this long, but my experience has turned around and showed me a day at a time that I can do it. And what we're supposed to share is what happened, what it was like, and what it's like now. And what happened was is that I started drinking, I'd say maybe around 19, 20 years old. And I wasn't old enough to get alcohol, go buy it myself. But they had a fleet of Navy men in Long Beach, California, where I'm from, before I moved to Santa Maria. And I'd go stand outside the liquor store, and I'd wait for one of those sailor guys to come in their white suits, you know, white uniforms, and I'd say, could you get me a six-pack of beer? And I was so afraid to ask for two. I wanted to ask for two, but I thought maybe they might not do it, because they knew that I was underage, and the Navy guy went ahead and got me the beer. And I can't turn around and tell you what happened after that, because I'm a blackout drinker. I don't know how long it turned around and told me to drink, how long it took me to drink that six of pack, but I'm a blackout drinker, like I said. And me being a blackout drinker, that means that there's a lot of things that I don't remember. And to back up a little bit, let me give you a little bit of family history. I'm one of three girls, my mother and father. None of them were alcoholics. I was the only one that was to become an alcoholic. And when I took my first drink, I found magic. And what I was going to do for 16 years is try to recapture that magic that I found in that first drink. Only I always overshot the mark. And so I would, started out with a quart bottle of beers. And before I switched to malt liquor, I'd already picked up a felony because of my drinking. And my felony was for arson. And cop come over and he tapped me on his shoulder and he says, "You're going to jail." And I says, "Why?" He says, "For starting a fire." I said, "You got to be kidding. I'm a blackout drinker." So I got thrown in jail that night and got to go in front of the judge the following Monday. And because of my sobriety being so important to me and wanting to clear the wreckage of my past, what I did after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I got a lawyer. And I had that felony reduced to a misdemeanor. It cost me about $300 or $400 to have it sealed up. So I guess if anybody asked me if I ever had a felony, I could probably say no, because it's been sealed. And the powerless and unmanageable where alcohol took me didn't stop there. It was going to keep on going. And I lived in the same area of Los Angeles County for about, I don't know, it wasn't 45 years at the time, but overall 45 years. And I would start drinking. And then I would get disoriented. I couldn't tell east from west, north or south. So I'd see somebody walking, and I'd pull my car over the over the curb, and turn around and ask them where Compton was, because that's where I was raised, Compton, California. And he pointed that away, which would have been north from where I was at. And I can't turn around and tell you what time I got home that night because I'm a blackout drinker. And see, I didn't know that the first drink could take me to a blackout in other places. And then I would, I don't know, when I first started drinking, I was driving a 49 Ford convertible. And there was a few of us in the car, you know, it's in the summer, and we're drinking beer, and I got beer between my legs and in my hand. And I saw this cop in my rearview mirror, and I thought, oh my God, I know he's going to pull me over. So I told everybody, including myself, get rid of any open containers. So alcohol just started flying out the car, out of the convertible. And he pulled me over, and I hadn't gotten to the blacking out point or anything. And he didn't take me in for being drunk. But he says, I can't cite you for alcohol, you know, because I didn't see any of you throw it. But I saw it going down the highway. So I didn't think anything about it. Because one more time, when I pick up the drink, the will to me to care what happens to me, it doesn't matter. Because that's what booze does. It gives me the will not to care. And then I have failed a few sobriety tests. I have tried to get out of them. And the police officers would see right through me. I didn't think I drank during the day. I laugh at it now. And police officer pulled me over, and it was summer, and I had thongs on. You get out of the car, man? Yes. Here I am. I'm putting one hand on top of the door here. And trying to pull myself up and open the door and get out. And he said, ma'am, I think I'm going to have to give you a sobriety test. So he's having me put one foot in front of the other as I walk forward, and I'm not doing a good job. So I said, he says, ma'am, I think I'm going to have to take you in. I said, just a minute, officer. I said, this road is not flat. Can I do it on the sidewalk? He says, yes, ma'am, you can do it on the sidewalk. So I made it over the sidewalk, and I started the sobriety test one more time. So I got through in jail one more time. And when I say I get through in jail, I always ended up in the drunk tank. And I guess there was some fun to my drinking. You know, when I get thrown in jail with other ladies, one of the ladies that I came into jail with, I happened to know, and the other lady I didn't know, we just got through eating beans. You know, beans got a lot of liquid to it. And one of them decided to take their beans and throw it. When they threw it on this other girl and me. And I got up, and I'd already put my plate in the trash. So I reached down into the trash and got the paper plate out, and I took some garbage along with it, and I just headed it toward her. And then somebody started yelling, Matron, Matron! You know, the policewoman's coming. So it happened to be near the linen room, and so we've taken uniforms that you wear in jail, and we took them wiping down the bulkhead there. So we got bean juice and beans all over it. And so we got away with it. So I had some fun in drinking. I would irritate the person that got through in the drunk tank once I did. And what I would do, and they taught me how to do it, and I learned well, we would turn around and reach in and get the sheet that they're laying on. Pull it underneath them. Anyway, that's kid stuff. Anyway, as I continued to drink, I couldn't find my way home a lot of times. Sometimes I would end up in the driveway where I live, in the carport, and I'd wake up sometime in the morning and I would go in. And there was times in my early drinking that I didn't have any control. I had this good friend, his name was Kenny Boland. I went to high school with him. And he asked me if I wanted to go out. I said, okay. I went out with him and went drinking. And you know, I'm the kind of drunk that once I start drinking, I drink fast and I drink hard. And I said, well, I better go home now. And he said, okay, because he lived about three doors down. So we went together, and I don't know who drove home. He did or I did. I don't know who drove him. And he said, I'll help you in the house, because, see, I couldn't even walk. I walked down the sidewalk just a little way, and it had two steps. And I had to crawl up those steps because I couldn't walk. And then I was the kind of drunk that I always had the dry heaves, worse than anybody could ever have them. Every time I drank, I ended up with the dry heaves. And I didn't know once I got to that bathroom if I was going to be able to stay there, which is most of the time I stay there, because I didn't have the ability to walk. And I had to go to jail a lot of times. I went to Los Angeles, Lakewood, Compton, Gardena, Long Beach. And one time when I got through in the Los Angeles jail, you're not supposed to pass anything. Somebody wanted to pass a note, and, you know, brave girl here, I passed the note too. But anyway, I got out of hand because they caught me and they threw me in a padded cell. And so it was really important for me to look and see where alcohol had turned around and taken me. And I don't want to forget it no more than I do my name and my sobriety date. Because for me to drink is to die. And how do I know that? And I have not experienced it. It's because I've seen other people in the program throughout all the years that I've been sober that haven't lived, that had to die in order for me to live. And when my drinking got real bad, in my opinion, I turned around and went to God one day. And I thought, well, He's the only one that can help me not to drink again. So I asked God to help me not to drink. And I knew me asking Him to help me not to drink wasn't enough, that I'd have to make a promise. And so I thought, well, you got to think, Trish, before you make this promise, because, you know, I don't think God wants me to make a promise and not keep it. So I thought about it for about 2 weeks, and so I had to talk with God, and I turned around and told Him, help me not to drink, and I'd never drink again. And it was going to be about another 6 months after I got sober that I was 12-step into Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was two girls. One name was Fran, and the other one was named Sean. And Fran and Sean had turned around and took me to a meeting on a Long Beach campus. And Fran was celebrating, wanting to go there because she was celebrating 5 years of sobriety. And when they had asked me, do I want to go to party, that's all I heard. Was party, and I said, sure, I'll go, because party meant drinking for me. And I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can't turn around and tell you what I heard or anything, but I can turn around and tell you what I saw. And what I saw was, is when I panned around the room and looked at each one of these people in this room, I saw light in their eyes. And I intuitively knew there was no light in my eyes. And they was asking me to do real hard things, like don't drink. Well, just don't do it for 24 hours, Trish. And see, I'm the kind of gal that, everything that I did out there when I drank was all based with alcohol. And I thought, well, this is an impossibility for me to go 24 hours without a drink. You know, because the time that I quit drinking, I already got into straight whiskey, bourbon. Then I got down to the Gallo and the Thunderbird, and I knew it wasn't for a taste, it had to be for effect. And so I thought, well, okay, if I can't go 24 hours without a drink, maybe I can do 5 minutes. And I really thought 5 minutes was an awful long time not to drink. And so I thought, well, if you can't hang for 5 minutes, maybe you can hang for a minute. And I thought, well, that might be durable. But in my mind, it wasn't durable. And so somewhere around 60, 90 days sobriety, when this was turning around and taking place, I was doing sobriety 1/16th of a second. And what I was going to find out was later that I wanted to be sober more than I wanted to be drunk. And they gave me hope that I didn't have when I came in. I saw people, you know, like these two gentlemen getting a chip for 30 days. And I said, oh, I don't think it's possible to do that. And then when they got up to somebody taking a 3-year chip and a 13-year chip, I thought, oh, they're lying. There ain't nobody can stay sober that long. And what I found out, that it is possible to stay sober. But it's going to take a lot of work. It took a lot of work for me in my first few years of sobriety because I thought I had the answers and my way was the only way. And your way wasn't going to work for me. And what I had to come to realize was, when we read it, Never Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says we have to let go of the old ideas. Result was let go. You know, we had to let go of the old ideas. Result was nil. We had to let go absolutely. And then they turned around and told me that I need to play some more tapes, some new tapes. And so that new tape was that I'm not going to drink this moment. And then somebody said something else magical in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said, why don't you pray and ask for that obsession to be removed? Okay. And I did. And it seemed like 3 weeks went by. And after about 3 weeks, then I thought, I'm not thinking about it as much. The obsession is leaving me. And the more that I prayed and the more that I tried to believe, the less the obsession came back. And then after several months, the obsession to drink was lifted. And I'd like to tell you that obsession to drink hasn't come back in the over 34 years that I've been sober. And I'd like to turn around and tell you that when I come into you, I was very broken. I couldn't admit my brokenness. But it took me a few years to do it. But now, you know, they said you're only as sick as your secrets. And I said, I don't want to be sick no more. And, you know, it's no big deal to let you know about me, you know. And I grew up with a father that I was to learn to hate and a mother that I loved dearly. And the reason I hated him is because he was more physically than mentally abusive. And he was mentally abusive in the sense that we never really had any conversations or how you doing or how's school going or anything like that. And he was the kind of guy that was kind of like a gypsy. He was into real estate, and he'd leave Compton, California, and he'd go to Oregon, and then he'd go to Oregon, and then he'd decide to go to Texas. But the physical part, what got me a whole lot. I just learned to hate him. And when I got sober, I saw some little hairs right here on my fingers. And I thought, I'm going to get a razor blade, and I'm going to shave them off. Because I didn't want to be anything like my dad. Nothing. And that was being too much like him, having those hairs on my on my fingers, on top of my knuckles. But I'd like to turn around and tell you, because of the steps, because see, the steps is the journey, not the destination, but the journey that I'm going to turn around and take to be able to be introduced to not only the drunk that I become, but to be introduced to the person that I wanted to become. And because of the steps, and I'll tell you more about the steps in a little bit, before he died, I was able to hold his hand with love and compassion. That's a long ways from hate to love and compassion. And it's only because of the results of the steps. And I thought when I was 17 years sober that, well, you know, if I ever drank, it might be one reason why I would drink. And I thought, you know, if my mother passed away. And my mother passed away in 2003. And I didn't even think about drinking. And I've learned a few things along the line. What I learned was that I don't have to walk through anything alone. And so what I did when I got the phone call from my twin saying my mother wasn't going to last much longer to come down. So I left Long Beach, California, and she lived in Napomo here. And I was about 45 minutes late. And I asked this girl that I brought with me from AA, and I asked her, I said, can I hold your hand and can you walk in the room to where my mother is? And she says, I'll be glad to walk with you. So I took her hand, we walked in the room, and after I walked in the room, I gave her permission to leave if she wanted to leave. And I was able to look at my mother and accept the fact that the phone calls that I'm going to be making, all the trips that I made up from Los Angeles to Napomo, I wouldn't be making anymore. And the magic is, I didn't think about drink, you know. And my twin is a mirror twin. I'm a mirror twin, which is one out of every 1,600. And what that means is we look exactly alike. If I look in the mirror now, that's the way my twin looks like. But I'm left-handed, she's right-handed. Her hair grows one way, mine grows the other way. She was married, had 4 kids, and I've never been married, not had any. And but I loved her very much. I was with her a long time, you know, 60-some-odd years. And when I was traveling down to AG, Arroyo Grande, where she was at the hospital along with the rest of the family that had come down from down south, came up here, and I sat there day after day after day after day, and it took her about a week to pass away. And I was sitting there, and she heard me turn around crying, you know, of you know, I might have to lose her, and she turned around and told me some magic words, just like I hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what she told me that day was that she says, "Trish, stay strong in the Lord," and that's all she had to turn around and tell me to put back on track, because see. Throughout my sobriety, and I continue to build a relationship with my higher power because he's there 24/7. And I'd like to turn around and tell you a little bit about the steps before my time's up. I turned around and told you some of the things about admitting the powerlessness and unmanageability over my life. When I turned out, talked about the jail handcuffs, the different squad cars, the different drunk tanks that I was in. And what I was able to see in step two was the insanity of step one. And I had to come to believe in a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity. And if I'm only at step two and I haven't went three or I haven't went any further down the steps, I'm living a state of insanity because I haven't been restored, because I haven't taken that inner walk inside myself. And three, making a decision to turn my will and my life over to care of my God as I understand. It's also making a decision to see the powerlessness and unmanageability in step one. And to see the powerlessness and unmanageability. And making a decision isn't enough. I can make a decision to put gas in my car or go to the grocery store. And if I don't get in the car and go to the gas station, there's got to be some kind of action behind it. So I got to get in my car, go to the gas station, pump the gas, then the action turn I'm in taking. If I just say I need to put gas in my car and I don't do it, nothing happens because there's no action behind it. And step three is asking me to rely on a power greater than myself. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't think there was any power greater than self, because I thought I was the power. And what I had come to realize was that I wasn't, because of all the old ideas that got me into Alcoholics Anonymous and putting God on the shelf, because I couldn't have God in my life and have drinking as well. And then I was real scared about doing inventory. And what I found out was that fear will mobilize you. It'll stop you from going forward. And as I began to write, because they turned around and told me to put a pencil to paper or pen to paper, whichever one you prefer. And I started to write, then self-will says, nah, you don't want to see the truth. You want to accept just you're okay just the way you are. And then I said, well, I'm going to need some help because I got to dig into this power, you know, God. And so I asked God to sit right there next to me where I would have the paper and pencil, and I started to write. And I asked him to help me to turn around and write this fourth step. And I was able to write it, and I kept writing, and I kept writing until I finished my fourth step in writing. And then, you know, the sponsor usually help you make a time to come and share it with them and do a fifth step. And I was a little bit afraid of that. So I said, well, my sponsor says, so I better go. So I took my papers, and I went to my sponsor, and I turned around and told my sponsor, here, you read it. That's what I told her. And she says, I'm sorry, Trish, it don't work that way. She says, you need to read it. So I about wept through the whole thing because of the shame, the demoralization and degradation and all the things that happened to me as a result of taking one drink and 1,000 not being enough. And I was able to finish it, and I felt good because I got it out, and she gave me some feedback, but I had not yet learned completely to know that there's depth to each one of these steps. And when it says searching a fearless moral inventory, it means I have to look at it upside down, sideways, every way that I can. I can't leave nothing out. Because it turns around and tells us in the big book, you know, going home and looking over the first five proposals, which is the first five steps of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and be sure that I haven't omitted anything. I haven't left anything out because I want to build my foundation on cement, not mortar or sand. And so I did that, and then I think I was probably about, I'd say, maybe 6 years sober. And I moved to San Gabriel Valley, and I went into a women's step study, and just happened to be, and I get a lot of God shots in my sobriety, just happened to be a women's clothes step study, and they were on step four. And this lady had already learned the four columns that come out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because it asks us to look at the resentment, who we resent, and the cause of our resentment. And after we look at the cause, then it turned around and asked me to look at my self-esteem. And I had to figure out, what is self-esteem? Self-esteem is feelings. Now, if I'm feeling good, or I've got goals or something like that, I don't need to inventory it. The only ones I really need to inventory is the stuff that gives me character defects. The turnaround and changes my personality from where I am the time that I have serenity. And so she had said, if anybody wants to turn around and take a copy, go ahead and take a copy. Well, I was probably one of the first ones to get a copy because I wanted to know more about the depth. Because she had asked me more than just what my self-esteem was. It asked me how my security affected. And the opposite of security is insecurity, which becomes a negative. You know? And then it asked me, what happened to your ambition as a result of harboring a resentment? Well, my ambition just takes a great big old dive. I become distant. I won't talk to you. First resentment I ever got when meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, sent by two women, and this one woman asked this other lady if she wanted coffee, and she got her coffee and she came back and she didn't ask me, and oh man, I got a big resentment. Big resentment. And what I had found out was is that all the feelings that I become distant with her, I would not even sit around them, you know, and I just kind of just snubbed her. And what I had to come to realize was it was my expectations, because that's what a resentment is. Resentment is not being able to say no when I say yes. That's the resentment. Putting too high of expectations on you or too high of expectations on me is resentment. So my job was to recognize resentment as it's coming. So here I got this guy on the freeway. I'm driving a 91 Z28 Camaro, pretty fast car. And he kind of beat me up the ramp. You know, two lanes and it goes into one. Oh, I was pissed. So I pull up alongside him and I call him MF. A CC, FU, I'm going to tell you, I had a filthy mouth. And I told him, MF, pull over. And I guess that guy was so scared, he kept on going. He didn't pull over. But see, what I was to find out is I resented the fact that he beat me. And when I looked at it deeper, what I realized that my reactions to life, because of having resentment, that I hadn't walked through. Because that guy didn't do anything. It was all me. So resentments are something that's in me that I can't let go of. And as long as I don't let go of them, I stay sicker and I can't get well. So anyway, I shared this inventory with my sponsor and I'm feeling okay and I learned more about the steps later. But I asked around many, many a years in my sobriety, my early sobriety, what was the difference in between step 6 and step 7? One is a shortcoming, the other is a character defect. And some say, well, they just wanted 12 steps, so they added shortcoming to it. Well, you know, something turned around and told me there's a difference in between the two. And I found the difference, and I'll share that difference with you tonight. And what that is, the shortcoming is the action that I took as a result of having a resentment. And because of the way that I acted with that guy on the freeway, I ended up with a lot of character defects. And it turns around and tells us that that it can be removed. Ask Him, that's capital H, God. Ask Him to remove my shortcomings and my character defects. The only way I was able to remove those was to see my part. It was all my doings. Nobody can make me angry. Nobody can hurt me. It all comes within myself. And then, made a list of all the persons I've harmed. Making a list isn't enough. Just like I said, going to the gas station, unless you go, what good's the list? And so what I did is I made a list, and then I made an amends, accept and denying. It says accept when to do so would hurt them or others. And I'll give you an example. When I was out there drinking, I was kind of loose, and I went to bed with somebody else's partner. And I couldn't very well turn around and tell that partner, I slept with your partner, it caused havoc. And so I couldn't make an amends for the action I had taken, but I realized that I could make an amends by not doing that kind of action within myself, that way that I could amend it. And all the amends that I've made, I've had to have forgiveness. I had to be able to get to the point to forgive them, just like the four guys that raped me when I was 19 years old. I came to the point to where I forgave them, and I blamed God for it, and this God that I loved so much at the time, I thought He could pull me out of it, and He couldn't. I started drinking, and I got all beat up, and all that stuff that goes on when you get raped. I carried a gun for 14 years. I would have blew either one of them, all four, if it would have come in the line of my eyesight. But because of the steps, I had to realize what it was doing to me. By feeling that way and harboring a resentment against them, I had to let them go so I could be free. So see, it comes always back to me. And if I have a resentment against you, you know what? I'm not going to end up taking a pen and crossing your name out and putting my name there, because the guy on the freeway didn't have any trouble doing what he did. I had to put my name on there. I had trouble with what he did. So it's back to an inside job. And so back to step 9, I told you how I made an amends there. And it's very important to continue to take inventory. And what I was going to find out is that by taking inventory, I become free inside. And I learn from my experience. And I've been able to learn from your experience too. If I do what you do, I'm going to get what you have. And that might not be a good thing. It could be a good thing. And so now, if I start to harbor resentment, I got rid of it in 2 seconds. Because I have all that experience behind me of letting go and not letting people control my emotions. And prayer and meditation, I thought, well, God, I don't know how to do that. Well, I'm just talking to God and listening to God. And so my prayer and meditation has improved to where I use it in the morning. I thank God not only for my sobriety, but a bunch of stuff, and I ask for His will, not my will. And at night, I thank Him for another day of sobriety. And see, it's through the experience that I get from staying sober that I can turn around and do 12 steps. 12-step work, sharing my experience, strength, and hope like I am tonight. Turn around and telling you, no matter what the length of your sobriety is, you can do it. If you've been sober for 2 days, you can stay sober for 2 seconds. And this is the easiest, softer way. Because if there had been an easier way, Trish would have found it. And it's really good to be here. And I just hope that you all keep on staying sober, because you're an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're an example when turn around, my family looks at me and is proud of me because I've been sober Not because I've been sober for a long time, because it's changed my life and the life who I became. And who did I become? Just like the person that I pretty was before I drank. But I've become a much better person inside. Because they taught me on early on. Patience, tolerance, and understanding. And that's what they gave me when I came in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't turn around and tell me, oh, we don't want you, you know, no. Patience, tolerance, understanding. You go talk to a newcomer, you'll find that you're giving them patience, tolerance, and understanding. And what I was going to learn to do is to turn around and put that in every facet and every affair in my life. Patience, tolerance, and understanding. You know, so keep coming back. It works. I'm glad that you're here. I'm really glad I am here. And I'm glad that I come to the realization that it's going to take more than me to keep myself sober. And I'll close with this. There's three very important things that I've learned that I continue to practice in my life daily. And that is to never forget that I'm an alcoholic. I come to meetings to stay teachable because I have a quiet mind. I don't have any trouble sleeping at night or living inside me because I did what the big book asked me to do, to clean house, so I can walk on the sunny side of the street. And it can happen for you. And you might not, one of the hardest things you'll have to learn how to do is to reach out. I didn't want anybody to think that I couldn't do it by myself. It's about surrender in order to win. It's about humility. Turn around and saying, I don't have the answers. I need help. Just like the many times that I've come in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, had to stay in the center of the herd so I wouldn't drink. And so I will take everything you have and muster much, much more to turn around and hang on to your sobriety. And the end result is on page 511 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, Derek.
Let's have another round of applause for Trish. Okay.